The date is Tuesday, February the 1st, 2022, and we are discussing the book Peril by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. Alan Lemley has kindly agreed to host the questions at the end of this program. I hope you enjoy the book.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Peril by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa.
For the PBS NewsHour in Washington, I'm Amna Nawaz.
Google search dash Google Chrome, the jam.
1 year ago today, Trump supporters from across the country gathered in the nation's capital to protest Congress's certification of the 2020 presidential election results.
To use a favorite term that all of you people really came up with, we will stop the steal.
Around 1 p.m., as Trump is wrapping up his remarks in the park, the day turned violent. A group of his supporters on the western side of the Capitol confront the handful of police guarding the barriers and force their way through.
And in recess until the call of the chair.
The Senate was called into recess and evacuated. The mob of Trump supporters roamed the historic halls, damaging property and searching for lawmakers. According to an analysis from the New York Times, rioters breached the Capitol in at least 8 different places. Rioters, outnumbering law enforcement by more than 50-1, attacked, dragged, and beat police officers, crushing them underfoot and spraying them with chemicals.
They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects.
In testimony to Congress, former D.C. Metro Police officer Michael Fanone recounted being pulled into a crowd of protesters.
I was electrocuted again and again and again with a taser.
This is our Capitol!
In total, nearly 150 police officers were injured on the day.
Meanwhile, outside, as the crowds grew, so did the violence. Officers on site continued to call for backup throughout the day. And while some reinforcements did arrive from local and state and federal agencies, it took National Guard units about 3 hours to respond to the Capitol.
A Capitol police officer, Brian Sicknick, suffered 2 strokes and died that evening. In the days and months following the attack, 4 police officers who were on duty died by suicide. More than 720 people have been arrested and charged with crimes linked to January 6th. The physical destruction of that day has since been cleaned up, but questions of how to repair the deeper damage to our democracy remain.
I want to read a quote about you, Bob. This is from former CIA director, former defense secretary Bob Gates. He once said about you that he wished he had recruited you into the CIA. The quote is, Bob has the extraordinary ability to get otherwise responsible adults to spill their guts to him. His ability to get people to talk about stuff they shouldn't is just extraordinary. So, how did you get all those Trump insiders to talk to you?
Well, I had the luxury of time, and I disconnected from the Post, did not do stories, did not do television, and it liberated me to go and use the old Bernstein technique, knock on doors, get into people's homes. And if you think we can do this reporting on the internet or even the telephone, we are fooling ourselves. And I told Trump when he called in August to complain, I said, you can't do this reporting by going to the White House. And I haven't been to the White House for a long, long time. And I'm sure I'm not going to be welcome for a long, long time. The technique is multiple interviews with people at my home or in their homes. And all you have to do, I mean, it's Jeff Bezos who said when he hires people, he wants to hire people who will listen. And not strategic listening where you're listening to figure out what you're going to say, but actually shutting down and letting your ears absorb what is being said in totality. And you need patience. And as you know, my wife, Elsa Walsh, was in this project as much as I. And she, if I may say this, she read the book and edited it 6 times, would kick me in the rear end when it was, you know, go talk to so-and-so again and get this. But most importantly, she created a work ethic around the house of this is your project. And if I had to go out at night or go up to my office at night after dinner, she not once dropped the penalty flag on me and said, hey, we used to be married, didn't we? And that commitment on her part was critical.
You literally showed up at some people's houses unannounced late at night.
I modified the Bernstein technique. I would call ahead and say, I'm coming. And they'd often would say, how do you know where I live? And that obviously is not hard.
I want to welcome you to an evening with Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, co-hosted by the LBJ Presidential Library and the Harry Ransom Center. For a distinguished journalistic career, Bob Woodward has been one of our closest observers and chroniclers of the American presidency. While Robert Costa, former moderator and managing editor of Washington Week, and now a political reporter for the Washington Post, has had an intimate vantage point on our own evolving national political story. Their co-authored book, Peril, is an account of the recent presidential transition. As we know, the peaceful transfer of power has been one of the defining features of American democracy, and a powerful statement to the world of the durability of our Constitution. As Peril makes clear, it is precisely that that is now threatened. Bob Woodward's career has spanned two of the most perilous crises in American democracy, the 1972 Watergate break-in and its political aftermath, and the 4-year assault on democratic norms and institutions that remains the hallmark of the Trump presidency. Peril follows Bob Woodward's recent books, Fear and Rage, and all three are noteworthy for their extraordinary access to the Trump White House, and in the case of Peril, the Trump and Biden campaigns and key figures in the Biden administration. All three are based on an extensive record of insider interviews, and each book has made news with never-before-reported revelations on a story we thought we knew well. Perhaps the most important question raised by Peril is the one only we can answer. Have we just witnessed the end of the Trump presidency, or are we witnessing some new and enduring force in American political life? It is in our hands to write that conclusion, and Peril is a passionate wake-up call for all who care about the health of our democracy. Our moderator, Mark Updegrove, is himself an accomplished journalist and historian.
Well, Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, welcome and huge congratulations on the smash success of Peril. It's good to have you both. I want to start with you, Bob. This is, by my count, your 20th book in almost 50 years. You've teamed up with some pretty famous co-authors. What made you team up with Robert Costa for this one?
Well, and there's an interesting moment in 2016 where we encountered each other in the newsroom, and Robert said, you know, we should go interview this guy, Donald Trump, who's running for president. People are not taking him seriously enough. And so Robert Costa set it up. We decided we would ask questions about the power of the presidency and what the president does, and not look for traditionally for a news statement from Trump, but go into what the office is and something, Mark, you've spent your life studying. And so it was over 90 minutes with Trump, and he said lots of things, including real power is fear, which gave the title of the first book I did on Trump. And he also said that he brings out rage in people, which was the second book. And so Costa is the real expert on Trump. So we decided on this project to really spend 8 or 9 months extracted from the daily news business so we could look at Trump and Biden in depth.
The election occurs on November 3rd, Tuesday, November 3rd. On Wednesday, November 4th, Joe Biden is declared the victor. And Trump makes a statement and calls it a total fraud on the American public. But then hours later, he privately asks Kellyanne Conway, as is stated in your book, how the hell did we lose the vote to Joe Biden? So, Bob, when did things turn for Biden? Privately, he seems willing to concede that he lost the election legitimately. And yet there's this public front that the election has been stolen for him. When did...
Well, very quickly, this period from the election up for the next 10 days of November is one of the periods we concentrated on. And you see that Trump starts this whole line of, oh, the election was stolen. Now he started that on election night. And it's amazing what, I mean, I just want to read, it's a little... specific, but on specifics, you know, as a historian, things turn. This is Gina Haspel, who's the CIA director. And on November 10th, so this is a week after the election, Trump has fired the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, somebody very well respected in the national security community, so Trump can install somebody who's going to do his bidding as Secretary of Defense. And what Haspel says is yesterday, the firing of Esper was appalling. We are on the way to a right-wing coup. The whole thing is insanity. He, Trump, is acting like a six-year-old with a tantrum. Now, this Haspel, who her comments and remarks, this is really the first time they're made public in detail. Somebody who worked as a case officer in the CIA, senior official for 35 years, spent her life assessing instability in countries abroad. And for her to make that assessment of Trump, when we first heard it, Costa and I were stunned. Here is somebody saying, not in some equivocating way, saying, you know, this is a six-year-old with the tantrum, and we can't run that way. And then a couple of days later, after they have a National Security Council meeting about maybe attacking or what they're going to do with Iran, and some of this appeals to Trump, and again, Haspel says, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to lash out at a country like Iran because of the president's ego? So Trump has done these things and laid the foundation for doubt and assessments of his mental stability. And as we report extensively, so many Republican leaders who seem in public to be behind him, in private, really disdain and ridicule Trump.
Robert Costa is a national political reporter at the Washington Post, where he has worked since 2014. He previously served as the moderator and managing editor of Washington Week in Review on PBS and as a political analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame and a master's degree from the University of Cambridge. He's from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It is an honor to be your publisher. Welcome. Thank you for coming. And Mindy, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, John.
Robert, so there's this behind the scenes effort to show the American public that the election has been rigged. Take us through that, if you would. What does that look like in the White House? The White House essentially becomes a war room around a strategy to take back the election. Talk about what that looks like on a day-to-day basis after the election is held.
It begins in a haphazard manner. Rudy Giuliani takes control of the Trump legal team in the days after the election, effectively elbowing out people like Matt Morgan, who were the campaign's general counsels and lawyers. He wants to be in command, Trump's lawyer. And so he starts to pursue litigation, working with various Trump allies in different states, but they keep failing court after court, state after state. The Trump legal strategy led by Giuliani is an abysmal failure. And the president begins to get frustrated. And so by December, now the U.S. attorneys, Bill Barr, have not provided Trump with the ammunition he wants legally or politically. Sidney Powell and her voting machine conspiracy theory hasn't played out in an effective way for Trump. He's lost in the courts. So it becomes less than about what you can do to make the case that the election was rigged, but how to find votes. And that's when the president begins to call people like the Georgia Secretary of State, wanting votes, wanting to find votes. And most importantly, after the legal strategy fails in December, in late December, the pivot happens from the court fight to the January 6th focus, and to make Vice President Pence's role an area of concentration, but also the idea of having alternate slates of electors. But because they don't think about this in a serious way, even organizationally, until late December, it's very rapid and not entirely organized. So when John Eastman, this conservative lawyer, and others start to think about having alternate slates, they're not happening actively in the states. They're only, in a sense, social media campaigns. So the big picture is, based on our reporting, we see this evolving strategy that has flex, if not streaks, of desperation to it at every turn, trying to give the president a sense that he can hold on to power, even though it's clear to so many around him that's not possible.
Robert Costa is a national political reporter at the Washington Post, where he has worked since 2014. He previously served as the moderator and managing editor of Washington Week in Review on PBS and as a political analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame and a master's degree from the University of Cambridge. He's from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It is an honor to be your publisher. Welcome. Thank you for coming. And Mindy, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, John. Just today, we saw that Steve Bannon will face criminal contempt charges for defying the subpoena issued by the House Select Committee. And those subpoenas cited your work in peril. So, Robert, I'll start with you. Why does the book matter for the committee?
Our book comes as Congress is investigating what actually happened on January 6th. But as we reveal in this book, it's not so much about what happened that day. When Woodward and I began this process, we started to dig into January 6th, but then we were sitting down with sources for hours on end, and we realized the story was actually just as much about January 5th and January 4th and January 3rd. And to your point about Steve Bannon, about December 30th. And that's such a critical crossroads in this story. That's when Bannon talks to Trump on the phone and says, we need to make January 6th a reckoning, pull Pence off the ski slopes in Colorado, and start to focus on trying to move this election to the House of Representatives.
In addition to that breaking news, you also broke news about the so-called Eastman memo. And that's a two-page document that outlined how Trump and his allies might circumvent the certification of Biden's electoral victory, essentially subvert an American election. Bob, can you talk about why this memo is so crucial?
We focused on it. We got a copy of it, and it lays out, it's really a game plan for a coup, but we paid attention in depth to how it was used, and it turned out that Mike Lee, a very conservative pro-Trump senator from Utah, investigated the allegations, the suggestion, or actually more than that, that there were alternative slates in the 2020 election. So here is Mike Lee, pro-Trump, very much a supporter, and he sees this memo and he says, wait a minute, alternative slates, why haven't I heard about that? So he sits down, and this is one of the realities of life in this country. A senator, sitting senator, can get almost anyone on the phone. So he goes around and calls the state legislators, the people running the state, what is going on in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia, and comes up blank. There's absolutely nothing to support this. And so he went on the floor of the Senate right after January 6th, when they were deciding to certify the Biden vote, and said, there is nothing to this. Lindsey Graham did the same thing, had his counsel investigate. And what we found significant was this is the Trump core. This is not Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leaders, but it's pro-Trump people looking very intensely and aggressively at what are the facts here. And there is nothing to support the stolen election theme that Trump has now been touting for about 9 or 10 months.
Robert, take us to the White House and tell us what's happening at the White House and in the mind of Donald Trump on the morning of January 6th.
When we began this project, we were like everyone else who watched the events on January 6th, deeply troubled and unsettled as citizens to see our Capitol as Americans stormed and attacked. And the initial reporting, good reporting, on Donald Trump's day was that he was passively watching television in the dining room next to the Oval Office, that he was somehow an observer of events. But as we went back and did the reporting for Peril, it became apparent that Trump was anything but a passive observer. He was aggressive. And it's not the day itself that actually reveals the story of the insurrection, but the days before, in particular, the night before. And on 2 days before, in fact, January 4th, he's in the Oval Office pressuring Pence with John Eastman, the conservative lawyer alongside him, who wrote this two-page memo, which many are calling a roadmap to a coup, and said to Mike Pence, listen to John, follow through with this plan. Pence resisted. And so the pressure campaign mounted in a way that history, I predict, will long look back on January 5th. This is such a critical day for American democracy, because you had senators like Mike Lee of Utah being pressured to buy into the Eastman plan. You had state lawmakers hurrying about trying to maybe think about alternate slates of electors, the Department of Justice under pressure. We'll hear more about the Department of Justice in the coming days as testimony is revealed on the January 6th committee. And you had Trump himself talking to Giuliani and Bannon late into the evening, talking to Pence in the Oval Office. This was the ultimate use of power to keep power for Donald Trump. He went to every length he could. In fact, he even issued a statement in Mike Pence's name near midnight on January 5th, trying to say to the world that Mike Pence is with me. And so on the morning of January 6th, he makes one final call, talks to Pence, and then Pence says no again, issues his letter, and goes to the Capitol, where protesters soon call on him to be hung. I started covering him over 10 years ago in the House of Representatives. He was a backbencher from Indiana. He used to pull me aside and give me a pithy quote. And I'd say, Congressman, you're pretty good, pretty quick with a quote. He'd go, Bob, don't you know they used to call me Rush Limbaugh on decaf in Indiana? And that's how I got to know Mike Pence, the congressman who was good with a sharp quote. But 10 years later, he's now in this position as vice president, the Trump ally, but also that conservative Rush Limbaugh Republican, the conservative constitutionalist and the Trumper. Which way is he going to choose? And it's a winding path. Eventually, he decides to not try to push the election to the House. But what a scene on January 5th when the temptation of power, the presidency, is effectively put on a plate in front of him in the Oval Office. When the president points out at the crowd outside on Pennsylvania Avenue, the mob, and says, wouldn't it be cool if they said you had the power? Wouldn't it be cool? Wouldn't you want to change an election? It's right out of Shakespeare. That was Trump on January 6th, watching events that he had put into motion, not just watching some kind of sporadic insurrection.
Let me quote one of the things I think was most interesting in this book, Bob. It is a conversation that Trump has with Hope Hicks. There are many inside the Trump camp who try to reason with Trump and try to get him off this whole notion that the election was rigged. Hope Hicks, who had been his communications director and then left for a job at Fox News, comes back to the White House in its waning days, and she is among the many, this chorus of voices, who asks Trump to step it down. And one of the things she says is, you know, you have to think about your legacy. You quote him as saying in response, it's not who I am to give up. It's not in me to do that. I don't care about my legacy. My legacy doesn't matter. If I lose, that will be my legacy. My people expect me to fight, and if I don't, I'll lose them.
This is their first broadcast interview since their book rocked Washington and the world with its headlines. Here's a look at the highlights.
According to Woodward and Costa, President Trump's top military advisor, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley, called China just 4 days before the election, worried that China thought President Trump would launch a military strike. He told his Chinese counterpart, "The American government is stable. If we're going to attack, I'm going to call you ahead of time." Milley also called China 2 days after the January 6th Capitol riot, telling the Chinese general, quote, "Things may look unsteady, but that's the nature of democracy. We are 100% steady." Milley never told the president about those calls, and Trump now says that if the account about Milley is correct, then I assume he would be tried for treason. While some have called on President Biden to fire Milley, Biden is standing by him.
I have great confidence in General Milley.
Former Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen told Marathon this week, calls like these are not unusual.
I'm encouraged the fact that the line of communication is there.
And on Friday, Milley, who is scheduled to testify next week before the Senate Armed Services Committee, told the Associated Press that calls like those are, quote, routine, adding, I think it's best that I reserve my comments on the record until I do that in front of the lawmakers who have the lawful responsibility to oversee the U.S. military.
And we are joined now by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa of The Washington Post. Welcome to you both. And Bob, let me begin with you. It's not just the former president who's using the word treason. Senator Marco Rubio talked about treasonous behavior in his statement as well. As you reported on Milley's talks with the Chinese, did you think you were documenting treasonous behavior?
No, not at all. I guess the best way to answer that is to tell you what we found. 2 days after the insurrection at the Capitol was a moment of maximum tension. And Milley talked with back channel, top secret back channel.
But others were on the calls, right?
Pardon?
Others were on the
calls. I don't know whether others were on the call. What we do know and report, which I think is significant here, after the call, he then gave a full briefing to four people. Gina Haspel, the CIA director, said to her, watch everything, 360. Talk to Paul Nagasani, who heads a national security agency, which does worldwide eavesdropping, and said, needles up, which is an expression, listen everywhere. He talked to the chiefs, the head of the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, and said, full time, watch everything. And then he called the admiral in charge of the region in the Pacific and canceled, asked him to cancel operations that the Chinese might see as somewhat provocative. And so there's nothing hidden about this. It is a top secret back channel.
We also know, Robert, that other officials were making calls to their Chinese counterparts as well. But were the Chinese right to be so concerned? Is there any evidence that President Trump was actually contemplating some kind of military action?
Based on our reporting, Chairman Milley did not believe President Trump wanted to go to war, but it was his assessment, his conclusion, based on intelligence and other briefings, that the Chinese were highly alarmed about what happened on January 6th. What Chairman Milley was trying to do, as we show in the book, is contain a national security emergency. And as Bob said, he was reading people in. While these calls with General Lee were held on a top secret back channel, they were not secret. This was not someone who was working in isolation. He was reading people in the national security
emergency. He wasn't going rogue.
He was not going rogue. He was reading people in throughout the national security and military community, trying to contain a situation and a president he believed was in serious mental decline.
And Bob, we also see in the book, it seems like former Vice President Pence was struggling more with this decision on what to do with certifying the electors than we might have believed.
Yes, we're able to chart exactly the road Pence walked. And it's not, he's trying to ride both horses, and that is do the is constitutional duty, but also keep the avenues to Trump open. And it is a step by step in the book, and you see in a way, Pence is with Trump. No, he's going to do the right constitutional thing. Remember, and in the context of all of this, this is a national security crisis for the country, and that's what has been overlooked in this. Bob and I had months to do the reporting, and you see what on the Pence issue, which you ask about, this really was a question of the legitimacy of the American presidency. And if Pence had gone up there in Congress and said, look, I can't decide whose votes to count, we would have had...
Well, it's so hard to contemplate because he really couldn't do it, but I know he was struggling with this.
He talked to former Vice President Dan Quayle, of all people, along with his lawyers and his advisors, trying to find a way about what to do. We show the agony, the uncertainty Vice President Pence had. There's this one scene in the book that still stays with me in our reporting. He's with President Trump on January 5th, hours before the insurrection, and President Trump has this temptation of power. Wouldn't it be cool, he says to Vice President Pence, to have the power to decertify an election?
Cool. That's one word for it.
They believed you.
Yeah.
Did wives know? Did children know? Did girlfriends know?
The really smart thing we did, neither of us told our ex-wives.
I guess Brad stepped away. All right. Bob Acosta.
Well, Alan, I'm the one who recommended this book to Don Quinn. But I want to be clear before I make a little statement. Normally, Accessible World doesn't get into politics, a little bit in history, old politics, okay? That's fine. But this book so traumatized me and so made me feel that democracy was gravely threatened. And if you see what's going on now with the actual executive orders that were not signed, saying, let's have the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Defense take voting machines. There was a coup in the making. The two heroes in my book are Mark Milley, the chief of staff, and one of them is Dan Quayle. He kept telling Mike Pence, you have no authority to do that. So I want to say this. I'm not going to review the book. We have others who will do that. I want to say, and I don't speak for Don Quinn. You got to clear it through him. If someone, I want to hear from Trump people who, after 60 lawsuits, believe that it was fraudulent. I will listen with respect. I really will. We're not here to judge. Feel free to say what you will. You're still our friends. And if you have a book that you think we should read that would explain Mr. Trump's positions, which I don't understand, bring it on to Don. I think in fairness, he'll do that. Thank you, Alan.
Good comments, Bob. Appreciate it.
This is Brad.
Yeah, Brad. Yeah.
Sorry, I did step away a sec. I didn't expect you to call on me so quickly.
No, it's all right. You're at the top of the list. So I'm just
I know. That's the curse of being the host. Anyway.
That's all right. Jump in.
You know, actually, I did not read the book because I find the whole subject extremely upsetting. I was always a Trump supporter, voted for him twice. But when I saw what happened after the election and his behavior, all that evaporated. I probably will read the book at some point. It's just right now I didn't have the stomach for it. But I do. I did enjoy listening to the recording. And I will enjoy listening to everyone's comments.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Brad. It's nice to know. I mean, we've got people that fall on different aisles of the political spectrum, but it's nice to hear that somebody that's a Republican that was a Trump supporter recognized that the man just seemed to kind of lose it. I don't know. It just I can't figure it out. I mean, I'm like Bob. It's scary that we came that close to what we've all grown up with as you know, the peaceful transition of power. It's what makes our country one of the hallmarks of the world and stuff. And it came close to almost not happening this time. So go ahead.
I mean, there have been other presidencies that were somewhat. Yeah, I don't know what the right word would be. I don't know what the word is.
Right.
The two parties weren't real happy with each other in the results, sure. But nonetheless, they went through the motions of having the, you know, usually the newly elected president and his wife stop by the White House and ride to the inauguration together with the outgoing president. There's been times when it hasn't happened, but at the same time, I mean, that's part of the American culture, the American tradition it's recognized a peaceful transition. And, you know, I'm really upset when I hear, Trump continually alluding to maybe running again. And I believe the other day he made some remark that he would, if elected, he'd pardon everyone who was, involved in the whole thing. It's just disappointing to me.
Okay.
I'm going to shut up now.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Those are excellent comments. Thanks a lot. Let's see. Sherry Wells.
Well, like Brad, I didn't read the book either, so I'll be quick. I really like Bob Woodward. I think he's awesome. I've read a couple of his other books. I heard a lot about what was in this book on the news. I downloaded it, intending to read it. I kept putting it off. And I finally decided I have PTTD, post-traumatic Trump disorder, and I just couldn't stomach another book about him. But I wanted to hear what everybody else had to say.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Let's see. Area code 623, whoever you may be.
It's me.
Joni.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's your new area code. I should have known that. I've added it to my contacts. Go ahead, Joni.
Well, I didn't read the book either. I sort of started it, but I was anxious to hear the things that, you know, the things that we just heard. I have not ever been a Trump supporter. I think he's really mentally ill. That's my opinion. I love hearing Bob Woodward talk. I guess he's no longer with us. And this Bob Costa, they seem to really do a good job. So I'll stop talking now.
Yeah, Bob Woodward is still with us. He's alive and well. So, yeah.
Oh, why did I think that he passed?
No.
I have no clue.
And Bernstein is too. He's alive. Carl Bernstein.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, good.
Thanks, Joni. Let's see. Mm-hmm. And thanks. I think Brad must have labeled your name. Thanks, Brad. Let's see. David Fauché, you got any comments?
Just a few. I'm not quite finished with the book. What struck me at the beginning of the book was the Senator James Clyburn of South Carolina and how he talked to Biden and Biden agreed he would appoint a black female Supreme Court justice. And this was this was like 2 years ago in the timeline or even earlier. And that's what they're trying to do now. I just thought that reading that and then having the events come right now to confirm that was interesting. The amount of reporting in this book was amazing. I'm intrigued at how they find out so much information. I'm surprised Trump allowed access after the first two books. I was a little bit surprised there. And I share Sherry's admission of PTTD in a sense as well, because, oh, I worry he will try to come back in 2024.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Let's see. Got somebody labeled with just as iPhone. You have any comments? You can give your name too, please. iPhone, any comments? Okay, LaDon, you're up.
Yes. Well, I did read the book, and I didn't find anything shockingly new about it, but it is very, very well written. And whether you agree with the point of view, Woodward and Bernstein or Costa, whether or not you agree with him, you know there's no fake news in this book. He has backup for everything that he said, all the quotes. He has written a recorded backup. There is no fake news, and whether you agree with it or not, you know that is accurate. Peril. I think it is a warning. If Trump is made president again, he now knows the levers of power that he can do. He knows how to make the presidency above the law. And if he is made president and has a cooperative Congress, one of the first things I think that will happen is he'll change the liability laws, where you will not be able to criticize our government, and our democracy will be different from then on. It will not be the same. He has the, if he's made president, he will have the ability to do things that he tried to do before and thought he couldn't because he was new on the job. He is no longer new on the job. So peril is a warning. And I did read the book, and it was well written, of course, because they are known for their detailed reports. So one thing you know is it is accurate. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ladon. Liz Lindsay.
Hi, I am not quite finished with the book yet. I'm afraid of how it ends, but no, I'm just kidding. I think, like so many people have said, I'm still, this to me is still like current events because it's still unfolding. And I too, my stomach turns every time I hear that Trump is thinking about running again. We've always known that. I don't know if he's doing that just to keep his base riled up or not. I don't know. But the book is very well written. I think that at some point it's going to be a very important part of history because it really pulls everything together so concisely and so clearly. But I did not learn anything new because I watch way too much news. But it's very, very well written. And the sad part of it is, I mean, I have read so many of these Trump exposés that, again, it is nothing new. And the sadness is that people who don't want to be reached are not going to be reached. And those of us who read this book have already been convinced that this is not the man who should be leading our government. For me, it kind of felt, I felt when I was reading this book and the whole Donald Trump administration, the way I did after reading Jackson Land. And then the book, the other book we read about Andrew Johnson, just the so many similarities, and I don't know. I it's clearly upsetting to me. It gets me emotional because I really honestly don't know if I could stand another 4 years of a Trump administration and stay sane. So that's all I'll say. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Liz. Michelle.
Yeah. I read the first book, Fear. And, you know, even though, as everyone's saying, you know, we all follow the news and a lot of this stuff is familiar to us, I think it's the fact that you're reading the whole course of what's happening, like incident after incident after incident. It's just unbearable reading this stuff. That one, you know, because it went so much into what happened at Charlottesville, just shook me to the core, because I've heard over the last 4 or 5 years, incident after incident, you know, particularly on college campuses, I've heard so many horrible incidents of racism and anti-Semitism and homophobia, and it's just horrendous. I can't believe this is what's going on now. And I read this book too, and, you know, same reaction. I can't believe it. I mean, I read it and I know it's on the news, and I know, you know, it's scary. It's just beyond scary to me what's happening. I've been alive for a while. We've had other Republican presidents. I never felt nervous or concerned. I may not have agreed with everything that they believed in and everything they promoted, but I didn't feel like I wasn't living in a democracy. I wasn't living in the United States of America. I felt that, you know, we may lean conservative, we may lean liberal. And the thing, there was a little line in the book about Bernie Sanders and how he said that the Democratic Public Party really has to court the working class. And I agree, because I think one of the things that we've seen over the past year or so is that the Republican Party is towing a particular line. And if you're a Republican and you don't go along with that, they're getting you out of office. Anybody that went against Trump, you know, they're just being booted out of office. The party is not behind them. But the Democratic Party has kind of a split. You know, you have the people that are sort of a little more centrist, and then you have the progressives. And I really think they need to pull the party together in some way. There has to be a little more cohesion, because they need to court the people, the white working class voters that went to Trump. And I think if the Democrats can pull these people back into the party, they'll be better. It'll be a stronger party. And it's tricky, because I think that, you know, people just have different ideas about how far you should go towards progressivism. It's a scary book. I don't even think I could read Rage. I'm not sure even why I read, after reading Fear, I'm not sure. I read The Whole Peril. I'm not sure why I did, because it's just frightening to me. It really is. So, you know, thanks for recommending it. And the discussion is interesting, but it's scary. So thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle. Betsy Grinovich.
The version I came up with from Bookshare had all three books hooked together. That's it. So that's what I read. I was a Trump supporter. My son and I have discussed the election issues, because he's into politics as well. And he doesn't think anything happened. I've not made a final opinion. I figure eventually we'll find out for sure, because I get stuff from really conservative places who think things did happen. But it was still good to read the book and hear their viewpoint and to read it. I wish they'd left some of the language out, but, and I usually don't read books with that much, but because it was a politically based book and for the club, I did finish it. But I enjoyed the authors, and I pulled off more of their books, because Bookshare has 37 of his books. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Alan, forgive me. Betsy is a dear friend. I only want to say I salute Georgia for their strength, and the Secretary of State, who was a Republican, who stood off the president. It wasn't just Democrats. It was people who believed in a democracy. Thank you.
Not at all. Crap.
Oops.
Oh, dear.
Never mind. Hell with it.
What a revolting development this is.
let's do something. I have to edit this.
Thank you for that.
Who's
Sharon,
next?
Sharon, do you have anything you want to say? You're muted. You need to unmute if you want.
I just muted everybody, so everybody, Alan, unmute.
That's going to be fun to edit.
Currently unmuted. Alt A button.
All right, I think I'm unmuted.
I'm unmuted.
You're unmuted.
Okay, let's get back to the thing. Sharon, do you have anything you want to say? Going once, going twice. Okay, gone. All right. Lynn Evans, do you have anything you want to say? Or can you get your technology working? You need to unmute yourself again. Lynn, you've been muted. So Alt A if you're on the computer. Okay, I'll take my turn. I read the book.
There's someone.
Is that Lynn?
You? Is that
Mary Ellen speak?
Go ahead. Was hitting all the wrong buttons at the wrong time. I read the book. Not sure that I enjoyed reading what I was reading. And I was surprised at how much he covered and how much background information there was. Not happy with the book. Don't want to get into a Trump bashing session. But I'm interested in reading Fear and the other book, and Rage. I've completed the book, and I certainly enjoyed listening to the half hour presentation that y'all put together today. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn. So, Mary Ellen, how are you signed in? Are you iPhone? Because I called on you a while back, if that's you.
I don't know. Can you
hear me?
You're
on now.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I can hear you, but you really need to know how you're labeled when you come into a meeting and stuff, so that when you get called on, you can answer appropriately. So take it.
All right. Sorry. I really, really like this book. And I've always had the question, when the Republicans had 16 people besides Trump, how on earth did they pick this guy? That's the question I've had for the last, since 2016. But I really, really liked the book. I thought it was excellent reporting. And that's really all I have to say.
Okay, and I'll close and agree with you. I thought the book was excellent. I mean, these guys obviously dug down and talked to tons of people, and I thought presented an objective report of what all happened and stuff. I mean, whether you agree with their politics or not, I thought it was good reporting. And I thought we got an accurate picture because, I mean, they talked to both sides, and like Bob said, I came away impressed with a couple of folks. I thought the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, had a lot of respect for the way he handled himself. I never was a big fan of Bill Barr, but you know, I think he was at least rational. He kept telling Trump he was full of it, about the election. And so that was nice to get a different perspective of him. And then let's see who else. I mean, I'm not a fan of Lindsey Graham, but I think even he, you know, recognized that the stuff about the election being stolen was a bunch of hooey. But
they changed their mind now. They changed their.
I'm not even going to get into the whole politics and stuff. It's a wonder that anything ever gets done by any of these people. Even all the stuff that was discussed about getting, you know, the bill passed, you know, the stimulus bill that was passed by Biden and stuff. All the hoops these guys got to go through. It's a wonder we ever get anything done. But and especially now with everybody taking these opposing sides, it's like people don't even want to talk to each other anymore. But anyway, I could drone on and on. I'm not going to do that. But I thought the book was very well done. And I thought it did a good job of giving us an unbiased picture of what happened. So I'll leave it at that. So and Brad, do you have something to play for next month or what?
No, we don't.
Well, the Family Road is an American Story by Joshua Traeger, and it's DB105723.
What's the last digit?
105723. And it's 18 hours.
105723.
Right. I had a great promo for it, but it didn't get into production.
Okay.
Okay. So let me talk. Did you say
105723? David Epstein left
the meeting. Okay.
That's what I got.
All right, Bob. I think that's what I heard too.
Yeah. So, from a hard hearing guy. So Alan corroborates. Good.
So Bob, what did you want to say about the Newswire?
I said, whoever prepared the reminder and talked about the book did an outstanding job. If I had never read the book, I'd want to come in just because of what was written there. I don't know who did it. I congratulate him. Alan does a lot of it.
Well, Don writes all the Newswires.
Okay. The reminder.
Okay. All that was the exact duplicate of the Newswire that he sent out originally.
Excellent job, Alan, producing it.
With reminder replacing the word Newswire. So there you go. So that's
excellent job setting doing that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, good.
They're looking for time when they will control the House and the Senate again. You can believe that these investigations on January the 6th is going to come to the end at the end of 2022 when the Democrats lose control of the House.
Yeah, they're good.
You won't be hearing anything else about it. Very little.
Oh, very. And remember fear. The key is fear. They fear Trump. Look, Liz Cheney. I didn't agree with her at all, but she's the bravest woman I know in this country. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The book next month is called The Family Row, R-O-E, An American Story. So I guess we're going to be talking about caviar. So
me to read you the synopsis, Alan? I have it.
Yeah, please do it.
Oh, yeah.
It's a masterpiece of reporting on the Supreme Court's most divisive case, Roe versus Wade, and the unknown lives at its heart. Despite her famous pseudonym, Jane Roe, no one knows the truth about Norma McCovey, 1947 to 2017, whose unwanted pregnancy in 1969 opened a great fracture in American life. Journalist Joshua Prager spent hundreds of hours with Norma, discovered her personal papers, a previously unseen trove, and witnessed her final moments. The Family Row presents her life in full, propelled by the cross currents of sex and religion, gender and class. It is a life that tells the story of abortions in America.
Wow.
Prager begins the story on the banks of Louisiana's Atchafalaya River, where Norma was born and where unplanned pregnancies upended generations of her forebears. A pregnancy then upended Norma's life too, and the Dallas waitress became Jane Roe. Drawing on a decade of research, Prager reveals the woman behind the pseudonym, writing in novelistic detail of her unknown life from her time as a sex worker in Dallas to her private thoughts on family and abortion to her dealings with feminist and Christian leaders, to the three daughters she placed for adoption. Prager found those women, including the youngest, Baby Roe, now 50 years old. She shares her story in the family row for the first time from her tortured interactions with her birth mother to her emotional first meeting with her sisters to the burden that was uniquely hers from conception. The family row abounds in such revelations, not only about Norma and her children, but about the broader family connections to the case. Prager tells the stories of activists and bystanders alike whose lives intertwined with Roe. In particular, he introduces three figures as important as they are unknown. Feminist lawyer Linda Coffey, who filed the original Texas lawsuit, yet now lives in obscurity. Curtis Boyd, a former fundamentalist Christian, today a leading provider of third trimester abortions, and Mildred Jefferson, the first Black female Harvard Medical School graduate who became a pro-life leader with great secrets. An epic work spanning 50 years of American history, The Family Row will change the way you think about our enduring American divide, the right to choose or the right to life.
Okay, thanks, Betsy.